Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. You've just heard the positive side. I'm not going to be quite that optimistic. After Bill Campbell invited me to speak in this panel, I discovered that I wasn't quite sure what the title meant, so I'm going to interpret it my own way. It's possible to pursue wisdom, after all, in different ways. One of these ways, dating back to the seventh book of Plato's Republic, is through education. So I'm going to talk about education. I decided to interpret the age of the internet in a traditional way that sees the world proceed through a cycle of ages that are related to the traditional view of a human being. For an integral traditionalist, man is threefold: body, soul, and spirit. It's reductionist to treat humans as only on one level, deal only with DNA, for instance, or only with IQ. It's equally mistaken to ignore the hierarchy of spirit, soul, and body. The best ages are those where spirit receives its proper attention and homage, where, for instance, society is revitalized by a renewed contact with the classical tradition, or the visible church confronts its spiritual roots, as in the Renaissance or Reformation. Times where intelligence is privileged over secular and religious traditions, like the Enlightenment, are inferior but still have their admirable qualities. The worst ages are those where the physical or mechanical are privileged over human spirit and intelligence. Traditionalists use the Hindu term Kali Yuga, the Dark Age, to describe these periods, though other traditions take their terminology from the hierarchy of metals, gold, silver, bronze, and iron, in Hesiod, for instance, or in Daniel chapter 2, where clay is added because plastic hadn't been invented yet. So today I shall speak of education in the dark age of our culture. The classic depiction of this age in American literature was given in the middle of the 19th century by Ralph Waldo Emerson in his ode to Channing. The horseman serves the horse, the neat herd serves the neat, the merchant serves the purse, the eater serves his meat. It is the day of the chattel, web to weave and corn to grind. Things are in the saddle and ride mankind. There are two laws, discreet, not reconciled, law for man and law for thing. The last builds town and fleet, but it runs wild and doth the man unking. The mission of education in the dark age is to introduce the young to a satisfying vision of the truly human. That vision is a legacy found in the great works of the past. For our culture, these works will be largely biblical and classical, but by mentioning Indian traditions, I wanted to indicate that important truths are found in many cultures. In the traditionalist classic, The Abolition of Man, C.S. Lewis reviewed the consistent assertion of the moral law given by the great traditions all over the world and throughout history. The rationality of the tenets of the natural law can be perceived by reason, but they are not discovered by reason. They are derived, in Lewis's words, quotes, in the last resort from a single center, carried like an infectious disease or like the apostolical succession, end quotes. We should not ignore in our own lives or in the education of the young the wisdom found in other cultures, but if we teach our own rich traditions coherently and thoroughly, students will come into contact with the best and truest revelations transmitted in other cultures. What's now called classical education has been successful in combining academic rigor with traditional content to prepare young people for creativity and freedom. The current classical Christian movement embodies a kind of paradox. On the one hand, classical education is the most recent cutting-edge development in K-12 education. Its current incarnation as classical Christian education began when a Calvinist minister named Douglas Wilson read an essay entitled The Lost Tools of Learning, a witty defense of the medieval seven liberal arts written by Dorothy Sayers after World War II, when she had moved from writing popular mysteries to translating Dante. Wilson turned the ideas in Sayers' essay into a curriculum based on the arts of language found in the late ancient and medieval trivium of grammar, logic, and rhetoric. In 1981, he founded the Logos School in Moscow, Idaho, to teach this curriculum, and he wrote a series of books to explain and defend it, beginning with Recovering the Lost Tools of Learning, 1991. Classical education, however, is not only the latest development in K-12 education. It is also the oldest, most tried and true alternative on today's educational scene. Modern educators want education to produce adults who are creative or at least productive citizens of a democracy. They feel education should itself be innovative. They talk about transformative new initiatives. They also want it to be child-centered, responding to each and every child's unique needs and abilities. The president's stimulus bill, for instance, quotes, includes a $650 million innovation fund to facilitate the scaling up of promising educational reforms, end quotes. This is from Education Week on May the 20th. And there's been more money added, not less, of that kind. Advocates of classical education believe that children thrive when they study essential subjects in a definite and time-tested order. Their curriculum is an integrated balance of rigorous instruction in language and mathematics, a vision that goes back to the 4th century BC. In Republic Book 7, Plato presented a curriculum to enrich the traditional Greek education in athletics and literature, gymnastike, gymousike, by arithmetic, plain and solid geometry, astronomy, music, theory, and dialectic in that order. The goal of the curriculum was to prepare students for leadership and service to the state, not for a profession or personal happiness. If, as scholars believe, this was the curriculum of Plato's Academy, Aristotle, who arrived to study there in 367 BC at age 17, was a product of the earliest form of classical education. Plato provided the model for liberal education in the ancient world. Augustine, in the 4th century AD, first refers explicitly to the traditional seven liberal arts: grammar, logic, rhetoric, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, music. Contemporary classical education is new in relation to recent educational trends. It is innovative and even polemical. It's also a revival of a curriculum and an educational vision that reaches back to the ancient world in the Middle Ages and was the gold standard for education for most of the modern period. Progressive educators find its claims paradoxical, since it argues that the best education for a creative and free future is through a thorough grounding in traditional subjects in an ancient and medieval curriculum. As in most dynamic living movements, there's a spectrum of attitudes in the contemporary classical movement. For some self-described classical educators, the attraction of classical education is the equal and opposite reaction to their repulsion from the educational trends that go back to John Dewey, as most are aware, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau, as some know. They believe that the ideal of innovative, child-centered education has led in practice to a lowering of standards in academic subjects and morals. Many feel that the educational policies that followed the Supreme Court's decision in Abington in 1963, which forbade public schools from beginning the day with readings from the Bible, produced schools administrators obsessed with marginalizing religion and so rejecting earlier and more successful educational models, with the result that many public schools are educationally mediocre and even dangerous. A 2007 survey by the Department of Education, 88% of homeschooling parents said their local public schools were unsafe, drug-ridden, or unwholesome in some way. 73% complained of shoddy academic standards. 83% said they wanted to instill religious or moral values in their children. The graduates of public schools do not, as a rule, fit the shorthand description of traditional Americans given by American poet Hank Williams Jr., quotes, "We say grace and we say ma'am." I like that way of describing traditionalists. For these educators, classical is the opposite of progressive. Most classical educators, however, take their lead from Dorothy Sayers' essay, The Lost Tools of Learning. The quadrivium, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music, has been considerably expanded to include algebra, pre-calculus and calculus, the life sciences, and chemistry. The trivium, on the other hand, is still fundamental. However, here there are different interpretations of why it should be fundamental. Pigeony of Douglas Wilson follows Sayers' defense of grammar, logic, and rhetoric as stages that track child development. Young children memorize easily. Sayers calls it the Paul Parrott stage. Later, they start questioning their parents and teachers, her pert stage. Ultimately, they can communicate their own ideas, rhetoric. The trivium teaches children what they need to know of the arts of language and communication when they are best able to master them. Other classical educators, I can mention Jean Edward Veith and Andrew Kern, find in the trivium the model for all learning. There's a grammar stage for every subject, no matter what age it's approached. If the grammar stage is pursued effectively, if you learn the facts of the subject, it will then be employed critically, the logic stage, and by those who truly master it, creatively, the rhetoric stage. This interpretation makes of the trivium a curricular model for every level, from elementary school to college and beyond. And then there's Latin. For many classical educators, Latin is today what Greek was in Dr. Johnson's day. You'll remember he told Boswell, "Greek, sir, is like lace. Every man gets as much of it as he can." A complete Latin curriculum aiming at true mastery by the very best students remains an educational promised land, and these good folks identify with Moses. They believe the reports they've heard of it. They've seen it from afar. They don't expect to live there, however. That experience belongs to the Joshuas of the next generation. This differs from earlier classical educators for whom Latin was fundamental. Remember Evelyn Waugh's comment, "The old-fashioned test of an English sentence is, will it translate? And it still stands after we've lost the trick of translation." Among contemporary classical educators, Tracy Lee Simmons in Climbing Parnassus, Andrew Campbell in the Latin-centered curriculum have made the case for Latin centrality in a truly classical tradition. The fact is America's leaders and creators have been classically educated for centuries. That the founding generation was classically educated was shown by Robert Middlecalf's Ancients and Axioms, published by Yale in 1963, Carl J. Richard's Founders and the Classics, Harvard 1994, and David J. Baderman's Classical Foundations of the American Constitution, published last year by Cambridge. Richard's new book, Golden Age of the Classics in America, demonstrates that classical education continued to be the basis of American politics and culture throughout the antebellum period. Carolyn Winterer's Culture of Classicism, published by Hopkins in 2002, narrates the educational and cultural importance of the classics up to 1910. In his New Republic review of Winterer, republished just this year in From Gibbon to Auden, Glenn Bowersock protested 1910 as an arbitrary date. Latin was a more commonly taught language for the first two-thirds of the 20th century. Indeed, it was the most commonly taught foreign language for the first third. As recently as 1962, there were over 700,000 students of high school Latin. Although the early 60s were not a golden age in American education, the decades that followed do represent a kind of iron age, not a natural development, but an aberration that is reversible and is being reversed by classical educators. The classical education movement is K through 12. It confronts university teachers with the challenge of how to contribute to it and build on it. Dick DeSurgeon presented one response that can be made for private school students and homeschool students. Another one has been the founding of Patrick Henry College in Virginia for homeschoolers. Its provost is classical Christian icon, Jean Edward Veith. At the University of Colorado, I'm director of the Center for Western Civilization, which seeks to support classical educators and create an oasis for their students at a public university through an undergraduate certificate, a kind of minor in foundations of Western civilization. The point is to give students a glimpse of the ideal of general education and to afford classically educated students support and encouragement to develop on the university level what they've studied during their K through 12 period. There are parallel centers on campuses around the United States. Each has its own challenges and opportunities, its own personal strengths and political obstructions. Among the problems that face efforts to restore to education its mission as a pursuit of wisdom, I would mention those characteristic of dark ages, the temptation to value the less than human over the human and the transcendent. Some of these, of course, involve the usual PC suspects that we all know about, but remember that our age corrupts even good subjects. Today at the University of Colorado, I feel we see liberal arts education corrupted by STEM programs, the profession of teaching degraded with technology like PowerPoint and often the internet. STEM is an acronym for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, but these programs privilege technology and engineering over science and math and tend to infect the teaching of science with the low ideals and low standards of engineering schools. They've so far been less successful in my experience with math departments. On September the 18th of this year, at a symposium to kick off program review of science and math programs at the University of Colorado, only the mathematicians showed an awareness of liberal arts ideals in discussing critical thinking, for instance, small classes for majors, etc. Science departments paraded their large student credit hours, SCH, and turned with relief to their research. The most tragic victim of the triumph of this way of thinking was the physics department, which at Boulder, as elsewhere, is the heir of astronomy in the seven liberal arts. The physics chair's PowerPoint flaunted a well-funded STEM program, the brainchild of a Nobel laureate who used technology to solve the problem of teaching science. No jokes about a final solution for teaching science. As he and a colleague had discovered, a technological solution for synthesizing the Bose-Einstein condensate. You see, you need clickers. With clickers, large lecture classes succeed in teaching science. Students in introductory science courses learned more by a statistically significant degree. There were only sullen responses to suggestions that the grade improvement was due to substantial reductions in the amount of material covered. Quote, there's no point in teaching material they're not learning, we were told. We could stop teaching everything by that rule. Supplemented by the Hawthorne effect, which turns out not to involve wearing a red letter on your blouse, who knew, but is the phenomenon that people tend to do better when they know they're being studied, a phenomenon that disappears when what is being studied becomes a standard part of the curriculum. Okay, I'll acknowledge that my own teaching, I use technology. The latest technology I employ was developed in the 15th century by a man named Johann Gutenberg. The printed book gives students access to great thinking and great writing. It lets them reflect or skim at their own pace, dog ear pages, or make marginal comments. As they read, they join in a process with the wise, creative, and thoughtful of the past 500 years. The historical record is often complex and even complicated, but when students learn about what has happened in the past, they sometimes see patterns observed by earlier thinkers and historians. Today, we like to proclaim that nothing is the same after some important event, so we can just start from scratch. If we do have to hear about past events, we want them laid out for us in PowerPoint or downloaded onto Kindles we can skim on the airplane. Give us the gist, and if you don't mind, spare us the history lesson. Classical educators insist on the history lesson, beginning with the ancient Greeks and Hebrews. Progressives like the part about democracy. They're disturbed when it becomes a little bit too frank. When, for example, Victor Davis Hanson writes, quotes, we should remember that the city-state, the embodiment of the beginning of Western civilization, did not start out so much to guarantee the right to personal freedom for all residents as to ensure the protection of property for a new meritocratic middling class of landowners, end quote. Cicero and the American founders would have understood what he meant and agreed with his sentiments. We're free and creative not because we inhabit a new nation, dedicated to a proposition, but because we're citizens of a General MacArthur called in his last speech at West Point, this beloved land of culture and ancient descent. What was the last time you heard America described that way? The minister, I'm going to pick up on Robert Frost here a little bit. I won't read the whole poem then. The minister in Robert Frost's Black Cottage had an insight students need to hear. Most of the change we think we see in life is due to truths being in and out of fashion. As I sit here, and oftentimes I wish I could be monarch of a desert land, I could devote and dedicate forever to the truths we keep coming back and back to. I like that poem. I do have a quibble. Lands that are dedicated to the truths we keep coming back and back to are not deserts. They're full of family farms and local factories and churches. Their families have a lot of children. Their citizens are also soldiers. Their story is our story. Our children need to hear it read to them when they're young, and they need to read it on their own when they grow up. Traditional education teaches old stories from old books. In his thoughts on English prosody in 1789, Jefferson reflected, when young, any composition pleases, which unites a little sense, some imagination, some rhythm, in doses however small. But as we advance in life, these things fall off one by one, and I suspect we're left with only Homer and Virgil, perhaps with only Homer alone. 14 years later, he wrote to Joseph Priestley, I enjoy Homer in his own language. I thank on my knees him who directed my early education for having put into my possession this rich source of delight. You don't need a classical education to understand Jefferson's point. When I was growing up, congregations still sang their version of Jefferson's insight. I love to tell the story because I know it's true. It satisfies my longing as nothing else can do. I love to tell the story, 'twill be my theme in glory, to tell the old, old story of Jesus and his love. Education in the dark age of the internet should prepare students for human fulfillment, whether or not the new order of ages begins in their lifetime. Students need to learn grammar, logic, and rhetoric by studying old languages that preserve the old, old stories that tell us of the truths we keep coming back and back to our whole lives long. Thank you.